This time on your weekly constitutional, academic debate over the accuracy of Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention.
His notes are finally published 4 years after his death in 1840. And immediately the accusations start flying. Well, how do we know that these are the notes that he actually took in 1787? And the first accuser was, in fact, the son of Alexander Hamilton, his old nemesis, who suggested that this was not an accurate copy, that no accurate report of the debates actually exist, and he was going to prove it.
That was Lynn Uzel, the former scholar in residence at James Madison's Montpelier. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's about Madison's notes.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
For 200 years, James Madison's notes of the Constitutional Convention of 1787 have been considered the most reliable, certainly the most comprehensive record of what actually went on in secrecy in Independence Hall all those years ago. So when people started to question the authenticity of those notes, question their accuracy, question even Madison's motivations in making the edits that he undoubtedly made, well, that got a lot of people's attention. Mary Bilder of Harvard University wrote a book a few years back called Madison's Hand, in which she claimed to have evidence that Madison had altered his notes in ways that went beyond simply being accurate. It's prompted quite a controversy among quite a few academics, including the former scholar in residence at Montpelier, Lynn Uzel, whom we'll hear from shortly. We'll also hear a contrasting opinion about the accuracy of these notes and Mary Bilder's book from Jonathan Ganap, historian at Stanford University.
My name is Lynn Uzel, and I study and teach American politics, especially the American founding, political theory. And the framing of the Constitution is my particular area of expertise.
And you and I are old buddies. We met each other at Montpelier, where you were the scholar in residence.
I was.
You have since moved on and have done great things at what, University of Pennsylvania in Princeton?
I had a non-resident fellowship at the University of Pennsylvania. I had a relationship with Princeton. I am among their James Madison Society.
James Madison Society.
Yes, they have a society, mostly of James Madison fellows, although I was never a fellow there. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, they have made me an honorary member of their society, which mostly means I get to go to their conferences every year, which are spectacular.
I'm really impressed because I, of course, am an alum of Princeton, class of 1983, and I've never been invited. I've always thought it was rather strange that Princeton has this great enormous structure and school called the Woodrow Wilson School of International Affairs, Public and International Affairs. And that was, in fact, my undergraduate major. So Woodrow Wilson. Very little about James Madison, who is, I think, far more prominent of our alumni.
I agree with you. I couldn't agree more that, you know, they do have this small center and it's wonderful that they do. But I am surprised that Princeton does not capitalize more on what is their most eminent of alumnus.
Okay, so here's a message to my classmate, Chris Eisgruber, who is the current president of Princeton. Chris, get off your butt and more about Madison. Okay, we agree on that. Okay, so that's who you are. That's how we know each other. Let's talk about your area of specialty, which is Madison's notes on the Constitution, the single most authoritative source I've always heard about what happened at the Constitutional Convention.
That's right. That we have several sources, people who wrote notes mostly informally while the Constitution was being formed. And we also have the records that were official from the secretary who was paid to write notes. But he only wrote about the procedural content, the motions that were made, the votes that were taken. But Madison's notes are the only source that claims any degree of comprehensiveness of the debates that formed the Constitution. So the actual arguments that preceded the Constitution as we find it.
I've always heard that Madison was perhaps the only member of the convention who was there every single day from beginning to end, sitting in the front where he could hear everything And that's among the things that makes his notes so authoritative.
Right. There were a few others who might get perfect attendance marks. Mm-hmm. But Madison is the only one who both had perfect attendance and who also wrote notes every day.
And that was with a quill pen. We're talking writer's cramp here.
Right.
I mean, I've always admired that.
Right.
Seriously.
And if you know what the procedure was, you have to be impressed by this. So during the convention, he wrote down his own special shorthand of the debates as they were taking place. And then he took his papers and he went back to his room and he wrote out a fair copy, which he would write it out in full and make it a more polished version of the day's events. At that time, filling in also his own speeches, which he had to do from memory because he couldn't take notes of his own speeches.
Right, he was participating.
Right.
In fact, he was one of the more vocal participants.
Some have said the third most vocal of the participants.
Governor Morris.
Morris.
And who else?
Wilson.
Yeah, James
yes,
Wilson.
James Wilson, and then Madison.
James Wilson, the second brightest person at the convention, right? I mean, many people comment on James Wilson. Great guy.
You know, yes.
Lots of stuff, but Madison, Hamilton, Wilson. Morris was very vocal. I don't know that he's considered to be the brightest.
He was very vocal.
Uh-huh. He was very vocal.
Not stupid.
Right.
But, you know, he doesn't hold a candle to Madison.
Right.
But anyway, Madison would take his shorthand notes and write out the notes longhand. And these notes for every day, think about the length between 1 and 2 Federalist Papers. Okay, your audience can probably think with the length of a Federalist Papers. He was writing 1 or 2 of those every single day about the convention 6 days a week. And this was his gift to posterity. This was what he intended historians to look to when they wanted to know what how the Constitution was formed and what the principles of American government were founded on.
That's something very important. Modern-day lawyers would call such a record a legislative history because, of course, the Constitution is law. It is legislation. It is a statute in addition to being our Constitution. And that kind of record is extremely important or can be extremely important in understanding the bald words of a statute. Statutes are of necessity, less than comprehensive. I mean, they are the result of compromise. They're the distillation of various positions and ideas. And so knowing why people voted for them or voted against them or why people put language in or didn't is extremely important. So this is a remarkable gift to posterity.
Yes, it is.
Okay, so what did Madison do with these notes after he'd taken them? I mean, the convention ends on September 17, 1787. He's got his stuff there.
Right.
He's got his notes. What does he do with them?
Well, for the first couple of years, he mostly just makes sure that the Constitution gets ratified and the new government gets established. So that's what he's preoccupied with for 2 years. And then finally, when he has a little bit of spare time, he makes his own copy, his own personal copy of the official journal records, which records more precisely all the motions and the votes that were taken. And with that, he uses his own copy to supplement his notes, to perfect them, and to make them more complete. And
does he do that immediately?
We believe it was shortly after he made the journal copy, and he made the journal copy 2 years after the convention.
1789.
When he
was a member of the first Congress.
Right after the first Congress, the first session dispersed. Then
he was rather busy then doing that sort of Bill of Rights thing.
Right.
Okay.
So the few moments he had after he finished the Bill of Rights,
right.
He used that time to make a copy of the journal records and to use that to perfect his notes. And so that was the main part of the revisions he made to his notes. And then later during his retirement years.
Wait a second. Let's just make sure we understand this. So he's a member of Congress. Very first Congress from 1788, he's elected, right?
He's elected, but he doesn't serve until 89.
89, so 89 to 91, he's a member of the first Congress. Then, of course, subsequently, he serves in a variety of positions. Eventually, Thomas Jefferson is elected president in 1800. Madison's his Secretary of State. Jefferson serves 2 terms. Madison succeeds him as president. Madison serves 2 terms. There's that whole War of 1812 thing. Then, finally, in 1817, I believe. He retires, right?
It's actually 18, so March.
1818.
Right, March of 1818, he retires and goes back to Montpelier.
Right.
And as far as we can tell, After the first spate of revisions there, 2 years after the convention, he doesn't really go back to his notes. He's a little busy. He's a public man, and the notes, as far as we know, are locked away in the trunk. But then during his retirement, he takes them out again, and primarily because the journal records have been published, and this time with a part that he does not, that he did not, we think, copy for himself, and that was the vote tallies, how the individual states voted, because they were a real mess. The secretary did not do a very clear job.
Who was his secretary, by the way? What was his name?
William Jackson.
So, Bill, why didn't he do a better job?
And he got paid plenty.
He got paid plenty. Was he drunk or something?
We don't know. He defended himself, actually, by saying that he had taken much more comprehensive notes of the debates. We have no record of that. So,
which is simultaneously dubious because, of course, it's very self-serving. But understandable. I mean, we have to remember that when you take notes back in those days with a quill pen, there's one copy.
Right.
Okay. Those things can get lost. They can be destroyed. So maybe that's what happened.
It is possible. And what Jackson claimed was that he lost a lot of money by not being able to sell his own notes because General Washington made him promise that that while members of the convention lived, that he would not sell his notes. And his word is the only evidence we have that that is so, because nobody else made that promise.
And yet it seems somewhat plausible. I mean, we all know that there was a rule of secrecy at the convention.
We do.
And that Washington was a very, very much an enforcer of that rule. Yes,
all of that is true. The question, though, is when was the secrecy rule lifted? And there seems to be a great deal of disagreement among the framers about when that was lifted. So a lot of them said it was lifted as soon as the convention adjourned. Mm-hmm. But there were others who said that there was some uncertainty about that. And there were some who said that it was lifted when the official journal record was published finally in 1819. That officially lifted any remnants of secrecy. Madison was still not sure. He had some scruples as to whether or not it might still be in force. He decided he wasn't going to publish his notes until after his death, so it would be a posthumous publication.
To some extent, he was motivated because he was in dire financial straits.
Yes, that is conjecture, but it is a reasonable conjecture.
Indeed, because his stepson, Payne.
He aptly named Payne.
Yeah. Very much so. Payne Todd, Dolly's son from her first marriage, had more or less gambled away a lot of his estate. And when he died, he knew that Dolly would be in dire straits. So the last few years, right there on the first floor of Montpelier in Madison's little bedroom, he and Dolly worked together on these notes, didn't they, getting them ready for publication?
Yes, we know that Dolly had some part to play. It was her brother, however, whose handwriting is in most of the fair copy. So he's the one who actually made a full fair copy of Madison's original manuscript notes. And if you go to Montpelier, you can see the little room, that little secretary's room off of Madison's retirement bedchamber where he spent his last years. Mm-hmm. And we believe that's where that took place.
And what was Dolly's brother's name?
He was John Coles Payne.
Very interesting. Okay. So Madison, the question I have is, Madison had already gone through a couple of iterations of these notes. Why was it necessary in his retirement to do more to prepare them for publication?
Well, if you look at the manuscript notes, they are a bit messy. You've got lines that are scratched out, lines that are written interlinearly in the margins. You have the 19th century version of Stickett notes, which, right. you know, sealing wax that he stuck notes to his original manuscript. And most of these revisions are from the journal record. And we can see that they are. They're usually verbatim copies of what the journal says. And therefore, he wanted a fair copy that the publisher would be able to just take and print exactly as it was shown.
So this was just a technological issue. I mean, I've got this mess because that's what the technology of the time allows me to produce. I want to make it pretty. I want to make it something that the publisher can publish.
Right.
Was that basically his motivation?
That's the whole idea of a fair copy.
It's fair.
It's fair. And not as in it is just.
It's pretty.
But it is pretty.
Okay, and, so that's what he was working on.
Right. And that was what he was working on in his retirement. But there has always been controversy about that.
Mm-hmm.
So his notes are finally published 4 years after his death in 1840. And immediately the accusations start flying. Well, how do we know that these are the notes that he actually took in 1787? And the first accuser was, in fact, the son of Alexander Hamilton, his old nemesis, who suggested that this was not an accurate copy, that no accurate report of the debates actually exist. And he was going to prove it by comparing Madison's notes to his father's very scanty and very
personalized. Hamilton wasn't even there for a lot of the time.
And he wasn't even there a lot of time.
Right.
But
I mean, he's a great guy. I'm a Hamilton fan. I am. But, I mean, the guy wasn't there.
Right.
And when he did show up, he was talking more than he was taking notes.
Well, no, he didn't talk a lot, actually.
That one day.
That one
did.
Day. June 18th. We will all remember June 18th.
6 hours on why there should be a lifetime monarchy in the presidency.
Which he always denied and said he changed his mind by the end of the convention anyway, and that's part of the controversy.
It is your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week my guest is Lynn Uzel, the former scholar in residence at Montpelier, who's weighing in on a 200-year-old controversy over the accuracy of Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. Later on, we'll hear from Jonathan Gnapp of Stanford. Stick around. You're listening to your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm in the midst of a delightful discussion with my old buddy from Montpelier, Lynn Uzel, who used to be the scholar in residence there, and who's been telling us about the continuing controversy over the accuracy of James Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. It turns out that one of the earliest critics of Madison's notes was the son of Madison's rival, Alexander Hamilton.
And so Hamilton's son uses every opportunity of any kind of discrepancy between Madison's notes and any other available record to show that Madison was wrong. And he also suggests that there was some political motivation to the revisions. Therefore, it does not take long. It is within a year you've got a review of Hamilton's biography of his father, which suggests that it confirms what had already entered his mind when he looked at Madison's notes, which is that they bear the suggestion of later thoughts. So you already have the accusation that Madison revised his notes later on to support the Jeffersonian agenda.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about that. There was this huge split in the founders. The Hamiltonians were the people who liked the British model of government. They liked centralized government. They liked industry. They liked finance. The Jeffersonians, who by 1800 included Madison, were people who liked less centralized government, who liked an agricultural economy, who liked the French Revolutionary model. The two camps were as divided as we are today politically, and in fact said lots of nasty things about each other. So it's understandable then that Hamilton the Younger, and what was his name, Hamilton's son?
John Church Hamilton.
John Church Hamilton was accusing Madison of revising history, rather like I occasionally accuse my mother of remembering things that happened 40 or 50 years ago in ways that, shall we say, inure to her benefit.
Right. So, when I say that, I don't mean any reflection on your mother.
She's a wonderful woman.
Yes, I'm only saying that that is the tendency of the accusation.
Right, and it's understandable.
Right, if someone has a motivation in changing the history, then sometimes that leads to the next step of just the assumption that they would do it if they had the opportunity.
Well, it's human nature. We all like to remember the past in ways that are consistent with our personal preferences of the moment. I can understand Hamilton, the Youngers, feeling that way.
Right. It is certainly a fair question. That has always been my stance. This is something we should treat as a question, which is to say, we start with the assumption that Madison was honest and that he did what he said that he did, that these were the notes that he took in 1787. But if there is any evidence that there was any skullduggery going on, then we should bring that to light.
Right.
And this has always been the problem, is that the accusations have been persistent, but they have always been premised on pure speculation.
And indeed, the controversy continues, because in 2015, a Harvard professor by the name of Mary Bilder wrote a book called Madison's Hand, I believe.
That's correct.
I'm sorry to say that I've tried to interview Professor Bilder a couple of times without success. So I'd love to talk to her sometime about this. But what was basically her contention in her book?
Well, Mary Bilder in her book attempted to prove that she had finally found the evidence of what so many people had alleged before her, which is to say that Madison had written some of the notes later on. Mm-hmm. And it's important to understand that there was quite a bit of controversy in the 20th century. There's really, I have to take it back now to the 1950s with William Kroski, who wrote a book on the history of the Constitution, in which he was one, the most prominent member in the 20th century, accusing Madison of revising the notes. And according to him, Madison had replaced some of these notes, written them during his retirement. And again, he did not really have any proof except, first of all, he believed Madison had the motivation. And second of all, according to him, some of the speeches that Madison has in his notes could not have taken place in 1787 because they did not align with what he believed were the dominant theories of the Constitution in 1787. So he believed that some of these speeches must have been invented later on. And that was really the only proof.
But it wasn't like they were making reference to facts that occurred 5 years later.
Right.
It was simply they were inconsistent with what Kroski thought was the theory at the time.
Right. And so it was all based on constitutional interpretation. Mm. That has always been at the heart of the accusations against Madison. I shouldn't say that because there have been a few other, a little more oddball accusations.
It would have been something different if Madison had written a speech referring to the War of 1812.
Right.
In 1787.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Now that would have been pretty conclusive.
Pretty clear. Right.
But it's nothing like that.
Right.
Okay.
So his theory was that the Constitution had a meaning that gave a dominant interpretation to the almost unlimited power to the Congress. But Madison and Jefferson, their party later on, wanted to constrict the power of the Congress, especially vis-a-vis the states. And therefore, he imported some of those arguments back into 1787 where they didn't belong.
All right. So we've had criticism of Madison's notes from the moment they were published, accusations that he was reinventing history from the very beginning. And now we get to 2015, and Professor Bilder claims that she has found proof of this. And I gather that you disagree.
I disagree. Uh-huh. I should say, I'll start with what she gets right, because Professor Bilder has made one very important discovery. And that is that the last fourth, a section of the notes, were rewritten at another time. But then it was rewritten 2 years later when he had a copy of his journal.
Okay, 2 years later after what?
After the convention.
After the convention. So in 1789.
Right, when he had the journal.
Madison rewrote some of the things he'd written originally.
Right, and it is a section of the notes. And the question is, why was it written in 1789? And so Professor Bilder's theory is that he never finished his notes. And one of the reasons why I question that theory is because Madison himself claimed more than once that he did finish them that summer.
Of 1787.
Of 1787. Another reason is that the notes are too good to reflect a memory 2 years later, mm-hmm. that they are too complete. And therefore, I have an alternative theory as to why this section was rewritten. And that was because there were so many journal notes that he had to integrate in that last fourth. Because in the beginning of the convention, you had maybe two or three motions a day, and it was mostly speechifying, and that's what Madison was writing. But at the last fourth, you might have a dozen motions a day and committee reports and votes, and it was just a rat-a-tat, procedural content-rich few weeks. Mm-hmm. And it got messy.
I'm going to second that because my reading, my knowledge is not nearly as comprehensive as yours, but there were periods of doldrums in the summer of 1787 when not a lot was happening except people sort of restating arguments they'd already made. Mm-hmm. There were impasses. There were adjournments. But then toward the end, when people actually thought they might actually have a compromise and they might actually be able to put something together, that's when things were happening.
Right.
So you're saying that last part of the convention was the most difficult to record.
Right. And because it got so messy, I mean, think about it. I mean, today we do everything on the computer. And so you just revise as you go.
It's all recorded. Right.
But if you're writing longhand, every addition, every scratch out just makes it all that more complicated. And especially when The journal record is also getting more confusing in the last weeks. And in fact, it's the secretary is not doing a very good job in the last weeks. And so Madison is trying to make sense of it and trying to make it match his notes. And therefore, he found it easier to simply rewrite from scratch and to make it a cleaner copy. And I believe that's what's happened. But I think that people should take a look at the evidence and determine what is more likely rather than simply jump to conclusions.
And the conclusion that you believe Professor Builders jumped to is that there was something nefarious going on in the summer of 1789.
Right. The more nefarious accusations are actually what happened earlier in the summer. She claims that there are additional sheets that were replaced, and it is there that I've looked at the evidence, and I find that the evidence does not stand up to scrutiny. Mm-hmm. So if you actually look at her watermark evidence, for instance, we find that some of the watermarks that she identifies as being anomalous, as being different from the paper he was using, is actually from the same manufacturer, you know, made in the same general period. So if you are buying a set of paper, this is from J. Wattman and Sons, paper manufacturer from England, then you could have a multiple numbers of different kinds of watermarks from that manufacturer. And he did throughout the summer. So one of her pieces of evidence does not hold up. And then as I look at the other elements of the proofs that are supposed to show conclusively that he replaced notes, none of them actually stand up, which suggests that these sheets were not replaced. Her various conjectures of the things that he altered at a later date are all based on conjecture. Nothing that really, we have any evidence of. So it is the same thing that we've had all along, is that mere conjecture that Madison altered his notes without any evidence.
And you have been instrumental in getting those notes digitized.
That's right.
At the Library of Congress?
Yes.
And tell me about that.
Yes. And here I have to give a shout out. This was civic engagement. I wrote a letter to my congressman, Bob Goodlatte, and I told him about the importance of digitizing these notes. I don't know how many letters he gets from his constituents, which come with footnotes and supporting documents. But I gave him, you know, the initial debates in which Congress purchased these notes and how important they were. And I told him that scholars have been debating this question about the authenticity of the notes, but it's difficult to verify because it's very difficult to get access to them. This is a top treasure at the Library of Congress.
Yeah, one of these days I'm going to have to go down there and put on my white gloves and look at
them. You have to spend months lobbying them to see them, as I did.
I mean, I just couldn't just call down there and say, hey, want to see Jemmy's notes?
Well, maybe with your prestigious name.
Oh, well, of course. Exactly right. Exactly. You know, of course.
But for me, it took me months.
Wow.
And I finally got access.
I'll actually put a note in for defense of the Library of Congress. These things are so important. Indeed, I will say generally that our physical archives are so important. We've got to make sure that they're not altered. We've got to make sure that they're not damaged.
Right.
And I'm glad that the custodians of these things are very careful before they allow access. Because, of course, I know you and I trust you, and I know you wouldn't go there and start changing things or stealing things. But we've got to make sure that nobody does, because that's how we know what happened. That is us. That's our identity. It's our history.
Right.
It's our DNA. I've actually had access over the years to various archives, and although I was gratified that I could get access relatively easily, I thought to myself, now, if I were not, if I had bad motives, I might just go and take things.
Right. And you have to realize that Madison's notes have been labeled a top treasure.
They are a top treasure.
There are fewer than 20 manuscripts that are labeled a top treasure, and they include the original Constitution and Jefferson's copy of the Declaration of Independence. That's how important they are.
Did I tell you that I once went to the National Archives and I talked to the last person, who actually physically touched.
I listened to the show.
It was fantastic, wasn't it? And you remember that. She's a wonderful woman. And I actually said, no, you let yourself touch that, just a little corner of it. She said, yes, I did. So I reached over and I touched her hand like I'm touching yours now. So you are now second degree. You have touched the hand of a person, me, who has touched the hand of the last person to physically touch the Constitution. Don't you feel special?
I do feel special. I would have felt special just to touch your hand.
Honored by that. All right. So to summarize then, this is a long-term debate. You don't believe that Professor Builder's discoveries are in any way definitive. that there's not enough evidence for the conclusion that there was some sort of intentional alteration.
That's right. And I believe there should be a debate about this. Mm-hmm. We should treat this as a question. The problem is this book came out and everyone came to a rush to judgment that it was now a proven fact that Madison had doctored his notes. And that's moving way too quickly. We need to go back, examine the evidence, and treat this as a question.
Well, Lynn Yazell, this has been a fascinating discussion about Madison's notes and about the 200-year controversy over them and the latest iteration of that controversy. And as always, I value your erudition and your scholarship. So thank you for sharing it with us today.
It's been an absolute delight, Stuart, anytime.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time for a different perspective on the ongoing debate over Madison's notes.
I'm Jonathan Ganep, and I'm an assistant professor of history here at Stanford University, specializing in early American history, but especially the history of the creation and early understanding of the United States Constitution. I have a book that will be out actually this October from Harvard University Press, called The Second Creation, Fixing the American Constitution in the Founding Era, which tries to reimagine the conventional story of American constitutional creation by looking very seriously at the decade after the Constitution is written and ratified, and how this sometimes neglected but really formative period in American constitutional history did an enormous amount to shape how people fundamentally understood what kind of thing the Constitution was, and from there, how one might make sense of interpreting it. So given that, my interest in Madison's notes and scholarship on it is obviously very relevant to the kinds of questions I ask.
Well, Jonathan, I congratulate you. I've often thought of the 1790s, which is basically the decade you're talking about.
Exactly.
Is a dark period, at least in the popular understanding of American history. And I'm sure there are many historians out there who've concentrated on it for years and years and know all about it. But for most of us, it was, you know, Declaration of Independence, Constitution, and then, you know, Civil War.
Exactly. Here you are. You're helping to sell my book with these sage words.
Well, let's talk about Madison's notes, because as you and I both know, they are typically considered to be the single most authoritative version of what happened during the Constitutional Convention. Madison was there pretty much every day. He might have been one of the very few people who actually had a perfect attendance record there, and he was there with his quill pen and he was taking notes. And yet, there is some question as to how accurate those notes are, or if perhaps they have been altered. What do you think about all this?
Yeah, so certainly, it's an extraordinarily important question because, for obvious reasons, the Constitutional Convention is one of the most important episodes in United States history that we can study. And we don't have much documentation outside of Madison's notes. So they've always served an extraordinarily important purpose. But I think it's important to keep in mind what we're looking for and what kind of standards we have in mind. So, for instance, the idea that there are revisions in the notes of some kind has been well known for the better part of a century and has been widely acknowledged and, at least to a certain extent, I don't think has been meaningfully disputed. Second of all, we can certainly get into the question of how much were they revised, what were the character of the revisions, how would those change how we think about the source itself. Even in the worst possible scenario, we would be dealing with a historical source that is then not so different than most historical sources that we're forced to make sense of, which are not pristine and perfect in ways that we might hope or imagine, but offer a particular perspective from somebody who is situated in a set of events or had a particular way of thinking about things, or often through just the sort of short-sightedness that all people unwittingly have, offered testimony as much to that as the thing that they were witnessing.
Jonathan, you're saying that people spin things?
No, I'm saying that any Most historical sources that we have, almost all historical sources that we have, are from the perspective of human beings. And for instance, if we have letters from the Revolutionary War, or if we have correspondence between Abraham Lincoln and a correspondent, what we are getting there is documentation to work with that offers a certain set of perspectives on the world that need to always be taken into account when we try to make sense of what these things can tell us about the past. That's something that's really foundational to historical study.
But I'm perfectly truthful and objective in everything I say and do.
So I think the important point is, and I think you would wholly agree with this, that even if you're always trying to be truthful and objective, and you might well, of course, be, there will still be certain things about how you frame things or how you talk about them or certain assumptions that you make that offer a sense of perspective. And depending upon the questions you're asking, that sense of perspective can be revealing. I think the wrong way to think about it is truth versus distortion. I think the right way to think of it is the evidence that we have before us can be a record of a variety of different kinds of things. And depending upon what we're looking for, those kinds of unwitting tacit assumptions or ways of framing questions or ways of drawing distinctions can offer insight into how one's mind is working or how people at the time thought, that is often very revealing and very helpful historically. So not a distortion, but actually very revealing, I would say.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Jonathan Ganap, who teaches American history at Stanford University. And he's weighing in on the controversy, the continuing 200-year-old controversy over the accuracy of Madison's notes of the Constitutional Convention. After the break, we'll speak some more with Jonathan Ganap. Stick around. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to continue my discussion with Jonathan Ganap of Stanford University, all about the accuracy of Madison's notes. Now, everybody agrees that Madison revised them, but was he accurate when he did so? That's where the controversy lies.
People at Montpelier are very open about the fact that Madison went through a series of revisions and preparation, especially during his retirement period in the 1830s. They'll tell you when you go on the house tour that, you know, that's where he sat with Dolly and with his secretary, and they all, you know, sat down and went through the notes. But you've hit upon something that's extremely important, that every single human being does have his or her own perspective. And whether that person is trying very diligently or not to be as objective and as truthful as possible, there is always going to be a matter of perspective. So that's a very good starting point. But as you know, of course, there's been a great controversy over the past few years, prompted by a very well-received and respected book by Mary Bilder of Harvard University, who suggested that perhaps Madison's revisions and editing of his notes went a little bit further than legitimate editing should. Have you entered into this controversy? Have you entered into this fray?
Sure. So I will, for starters, I think the biggest claim that Mary Bilder, whose book I think is wonderful, and I think is a real model of great historical scholarship, I think that the primary claim that everything else sort of relies upon is a claim that I don't think anybody, at least to my knowledge, has refuted, which is this recognition that Madison's notes were unfinished or had not actually been written up as formal notes at the end of the convention. So by what I mean, the final weeks of the convention, he had an enormous workload. He was dealing with health issues. He didn't actually complete the pages of the notes that cover August 22nd to September 17th. So the convention begins in May 25th. It ends on September 17th, this last quarter of the convention. It now seems clear that the pages we have from the notes were written at the earliest in the late summer or fall of 1789. Mm-hmm. So the last quarter of the convention we know was written 2 years later, and we know this because this was the time that Madison obtained a copy of the official records of the convention, and it's pretty clear based on how he included information from the official records into his notes that this portion of the convention was written in 1789. He then also went back and added in portions of the official record to the remainder of the notes. So it seems to me that if we're going to concede this claim that Madison finished his notes not in 1787 but in 1789 and finished such a significant, important part of them, then anything else we might argue about, I think, needs to be kept then in the perspective of that concession. If we're willing to concede that, then I think we're all agreeing that the notes are to a significant extent revised. Until that claim is sort of disputed, I think that even if you disagree with different aspects of Builder's book and different arguments she makes, and I don't necessarily agree with all of them. I think one of the exciting things about the book is that it provokes further conversation. But if we're willing to accept that the notes were finished in 1789, then I think in some ways all the rest is all subsidiary arguments. And then I will second add, so if we're already, if her sort of foundational assumption, I think, has very much been conceded, as best I can tell by all sides, I think the most interesting things that Mary Builder points to in the book are perhaps, are not the things that might come across as more provocative, where there is potential insinuation that Madison is deliberately changing things and perhaps even doing so for partisan reasons. I think the much more interesting set of claims she makes is how, in many ways, Madison is sitting down in the fall of 1789, and he is actually trying in good faith to complete the notes as faithfully as he can. But precisely because 2 years have passed and the Constitution has dramatically changed in people's eyes, if only because it was actually ratified and has become the law of the land, and he spent an entire year in Congress arguing about the Constitution, trying to make sense of it, it would be impossible for any human being, even if they are proceeding in the best faith imaginable, not to see the Constitution and the convention that created it 2 years later in a different way, to emphasize things differently, to look at the official record of the convention and make different choices about what kinds of stuff should be included and what kinds of stuff is less important.
Yeah. That's a really good point, Jonathan, because, of course, 1789 was a pretty big year. First Congress, the drafting, and the ultimately, a year or two later, the ratification of the Bill of Rights. You know, Madison had been working it. He'd been actually in the process of creating, bringing to life this government that he'd sketched out on paper. I think that's a valid point. I mean, your perspective has to change based upon what you've been doing.
So when we're trying to make sense of the notes and what value they have, I think one of the most important arguments that Mary Builder makes is that, properly understood, the revisions don't diminish the importance of the notes or their value as a historical source, but in fact enhance them. And I think the reason why is because they become a record of a lot of important things that we tend to easily forget. It is very hard for us to return to the late 18th century when the American Republic was fragile, when it was unclear what kind of constitutional settlement would be agreed upon and whether it would in fact work. In other words, people at the time did not see, and especially members of the Constitutional Convention, did not see the Constitution as the Constitution. That's something that we see easily now because 231 years later, we still have the Constitution and we consider it absolutely essential to American identity and everything we are as a people and the nation that we make up. But that was not clear or obvious at the time. And why would it be? You're getting rid of the Articles of Confederation, one constitutional system. You're replacing it with a new one. Maybe it'll work. Maybe it won't even be ratified. So as Madison, over time, adds things to the notes, standardizes the notes, tries to standardize terminology, again, in many cases, not because he's trying to be duplicitous, but in fact because he's trying to create a more authentic record, a more coherent record. But what he's showing in that process is not just a record of what happened in 1787, but a record of how the Constitution is turning into the Constitution, about how certain aspects of the Constitution that we take for granted, that were not obviously there when the Constitution was first written, are now slowly beginning to cohere around it. And the notes then become a record of that dynamic process as much as something static and fixed in the summer of 1787. And I think that's the great value of the book, ultimately, that we see the notes as more than just a record of the Constitutional Convention, but a record of the early dynamism of Constitution making itself, which to me is the real story that we need to appreciate, and especially the story we need to appreciate about Madison. That's a story not about thought, but a story about thinking, about thought in motion, about how people's ideas and assumptions are being radically remade over the course of the late 18th century. And the notes is as much an archive of that as it is simply a transcript of what happened in Philadelphia that summer.
Okay, so in plain English, as much as we would like to have had a video set up that recorded every single word said by every single person from every conceivable angle, as much as we'd perhaps like to think that Madison's notes are that record, they are the product of a fallible human who had his own perspectives and his own biases, and that as hard as he might have tried, nothing he said could be considered to be definitive, but only his perspective that is influenced by the passage of time as well as by his own experiences. And so that's the way we need to look at these notes.
Exactly. And I think so, one, we need to keep things in proper perspective, that it would be utterly unreasonable to assume that Madison's notes would achieve the standard, the initial standard that you just laid out there, which is perhaps what we most desire, a perfect video account that captures everything that happened at the convention. Obviously, judging the notes by that standard, I don't think is appropriate.
There was no C-SPAN in 1787.
Exactly. But also, I mean, I think we need to appreciate that when we look back at the Constitutional Convention and study it, we do so knowing how the whole story turned out and how the Constitution that they were talking about turned into the Constitution that has 230 years of history and case law and famous Supreme Court decisions and so many assumptions that have become effectively inextricable from the document itself. And it can be really helpful in that regard to recognize why Madison's notes could never achieve the standard of a perfect transcript, because it invites us to remember that when we look back, we often bring a bunch of baggage from the modern period back to the past and assume that when they're talking about the Constitution, they are thinking all of the things we're thinking. So I think it's really helpful in that regard. Again, it doesn't preclude our ability to do good history. Focusing on the revisions actually makes it easier, I think, to better understand what people at the time were really thinking, to remind ourselves that we have to do that.
Do you think that Madison, I mean, you know, this is all great, and it's, you know, there's a part of me that wants to poke fun at you and simply say you historians like to argue with each other. Now, this is very interesting stuff. I mean, we have a tendency, the rest of us, the non-historians in the world, have a tendency to think of history as being written in stone and everyone agrees upon it, and it's a factual record and that's it. But really, history is just an argument. It's just a continuing discussion about what we think happened in the past, and that's what makes it endlessly fascinating, of course. But let's get down to it. Do you think that when Madison was revising his notes, whether in 1789 or later in the 1830s, do you think that he allowed himself a bit too much latitude? Do you agree with some of Builder's arguments, perhaps, that he inserted extra documentation that he shouldn't have, that he went beyond simply editing and tried to put his spin on things?
It's obviously an extraordinarily important question. It would require a much deeper investigation for me to arrive at an answer that I was comfortable with. But rather than just equivocating, what I will say is, first of all, one of the things I like best about Builder's book is she's extremely forthright about the evidence and the different kinds of claims that follow from that. So if you look very carefully at when she makes these arguments that have been the source of the greatest controversy, and particularly when she talks about the evidence that underlies it in the appendix to the book, which is called The Evidence, she often uses phrases like plausibly, likely, Madison appears to have, the likely timing of this section is speculative, but supporting evidence suggests. I think very rarely does she herself actually contend that we clearly know these things. What she is doing is presenting evidence that is suggestive and points us in that direction, but many questions remain unanswered. To your bigger question, with those caveats in mind, I think she makes a good case for why we should think that he did more than merely edit in certain situations, but she's very forthright that she can't prove that, at least until we make further discoveries, potentially forensic discoveries or new documentation shows up. But when I'm trying to draw the distinction between merely editing or actually doing something that we would think is of a more serious kind of revision, we have to remind ourselves that the standards of modern documentary work were not really in place at the time. As a result, it's sometimes hard, it's easy to judge something that Madison may or may not have done by the standard of, well, was he just sort of copy editing, correcting for punctuation, or was he actually dramatically changing his position on things? There's a decent chance that he was, again, in good faith, trying to offer a clearer conception of what he genuinely believed he had always thought. But by our standards, we would suggest that was more of a revision. I don't tend to think that at any point Madison actively, knowingly tried to manipulate the record. I think Bilder gives us good food for thought for not foreclosing that possibility, and we need to wrestle with it. But those are not the things about Madison's notes that interest me most. I certainly have not been shown evidence that leads me to think that he absolutely did something that in our eyes would constitute a real change or distortion of that sort. But I think there's reasons to think that he's replacing different sheets of paper potentially. There are important speeches on those, that there are ways that those speeches can be more gently revised that from a historical perspective is significant.
Well, Jonathan Gnapp of Stanford University, this has been a fascinating and enlightening discussion. And I'm relieved that you at least leave open the possibility that Jemmy Madison was in fact a decent fellow. Because of course, we love him here on this show. We're underwritten by Montpelier.
Yeah.
But what a very, very interesting debate. And I admire the continuing debate among you historians. And I hope eventually you come to an absolute conception of the truth.
That is certainly the goal we all work towards, right?
Thanks a lot, Jonathan.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much to both of our guests, Jonathan Gnapp of Stanford University. We hope you'll buy a copy or two of his book. And, of course, Lynn Uzel, the former scholar in residence at Montpelier, who's also coming out with a book in the near future that's attempting a definitive appraisal of the records of the Constitutional Convention. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Cal Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.